You sound like you're going to throw up. You were just like, this man is super unison.
I think it's okay. Yeah, I'm fine. Yeah, I was like figuring out if I should lean in or lean away from the microphone. I'm like looking at my bars as I'm talking. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. Here with me on the other line is Keith Foster from San Diego, California. I don't know why I'm a radio guy right now.
I know. I was wondering that too. And with me is Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California.
Mm-hmm. And actually, it hasn't been too long since we've talked, because just a few days ago, we were having Friendsgiving over in Las Vegas.
That's right. IRL.
IRL. In the person. In the flesh. We could have done Jabber and the Drone live, but we didn't.
I actually thought about that, and then I forgot.
It's okay. I didn't really feel like, you know, setting up a camera and then making all of our friends go do something else or whatever.
I actually thought it might be kind of fun. I don't even know why I'm talking about this, because this is content you'll never receive, listeners. But I actually was like, thought it might have been fun if we had like all watched a holiday movie and like kind of riffed on it at the same time or something.
Right, right. Well, you know, I keep teasing the idea of doing another commentary track. We did one a long time ago for the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and I would like to do another, or, you know, several others, but, you know, it works better when we're in person. Just trying to figure out what that special movie is going to be and how we can work around that.
Yes.
If anybody has suggestions, any listeners out there desperately want us to do a commentary track on a movie that we for sure seen and probably have a lot to say about, send us your suggestions at our email, jabberandthedrone@gmail.com, or, you know, DM us on Twitter, @jabberpodcast, whatever. Today we're going to be talking about Fantastic Beasts, the sequel, The Crimes of Grindelwald, and at the end of the program for our Netflix homework, we're going to be reviewing 1958's Touch of Evil, and I am going to do a solo review of the Netflix thriller Cam, which I actually wrote that review while everyone else was downstairs. I had to borrow a computer and turn that in real fast. But let's get into a little consume obey. A little consume obey. What have we been watching? What have we been listening to? What are we obsessed with? And I'll let you start.
Yeah, so actually one of the things we did in Vegas was we went to a little comic book shop, and they have released first couple issues to Umbrella Academy Volume 3. So nice. I was super pumped about that. Normally with comic books, I wait till it comes out in trade. But I'm so into Umbrella Academy that I was like, I'll pick these up. So
he finally dropped it. Yeah, I read the
first couple issues. Yeah. And after like fucking 10 years or something stupid.
Yeah.
It's been a while. So I read the first couple issues. There's a lot going on. Doesn't really make sense yet, but I kind of expected that. So, but the artwork is done by one of my favorite comic book artists, Gabriel Ba, who I actually got to meet at Comic-Con one year. We actually did like a one-on-one thing where he, I was working on a graphic novel. Well, not, that's dumb. I was working on some comic stuff. For as a part of my minor. I minored in creative writing. Mm-hmm. And I
with an emphasis in comics.
Yeah, I did an independent study on comic books. And so during that time, I was working on like a script and working on some pages and had him like go over my artwork. And it was sort of humiliating. Sure. Because my stuff is so amateurish.
Have a professional comic book artist look at your college project.
Oh, yeah. It was like, it sort of, it humbled me a lot. He was very nice too. He was not mean about it at all. He gave me some great advice, but it was still like sort of a kick in the nuts.
Right.
And so I actually kind of gave up on all of it for a while there. And now even still, I only draw occasionally, but that's more because,
commitments, time, growing up.
Yeah. It's less, it's not like he like crushed my dream or anything, but it was like, whew, oh boy. It did make me a little sweaty.
All right. Well, that's cool. So, mine is music related, as per usual. On the way to our vacation in Las Vegas, I decided to check out this group I'd heard a little bit about called Super Unison. I think they're from the Bay Area, female-fronted sort of punk alternative rock, whatever you want to call it. Their first record, I listened to both. They have two albums and an EP out that's available on Spotify, and I was stuck in bumper-to-bumper traffic through middle of San Bernardino, as usually happens when you're on your way to Las Vegas. The first record is kind of more kind of Riot Girl-esque. It reminded me a lot of stuff like Bikini Kill and Bratmobile, Sleater-Kinney, like that type of stuff. Okay. But good. I enjoyed that a lot. And then I really like the second album, the one that just released this year, 2018. It's a lot more atmospheric, sort of has a lot of like mid-80s Sonic Youth influence. And then the vocals are a lot more intense and a lot more impassioned, and I'm almost bordering kind of on like mid-90s screamo stuff. I'm a big fan of this new band. I suggest people who might be into any of the things I just said, check out Super Unison. They're going places. Also, on the way home, I was listening to a bunch of music, and I think I sent you a link to the new Culture Abuse record.
Yeah, I listened to one of the songs off that. It was mm-hmm. fun.
Yeah, I'm digging it. It kind of reminds me of like early 2000s stuff. It reminded me a little bit of like bands like Rooney and Phantom Planet and like that kind of stuff. Like sort of like post garage rock revival, but with like more of a beachy feel to it. I enjoyed their first record too when that came out, and I'm liking the new one. Okay, cool. Well, let's talk some movie news. We got a few stories that popped up. And do you want to start with yours?
Sure, yeah. So mine is actually a bit of a tag-on from my Consumo Bay on, I think, the last episode. I guess, so the last episode we did, I mentioned how I've been reading the omnibus for Grant Morrison's graphic novel, The Invisibles. And actually, I failed to bring up the fact that he's currently adapting it as a part of a deal he has with Universal Cable Productions. Mm-hmm. So they have produced, they produced his graphic novel Happy for Sci-Fi, starring Christopher Maloney and Patton Oswalt, which I heard good things about. And I've been meaning, I want to check it out, but I just haven't had an opportunity to. And I guess a part of his deal, he's now developing The Invisibles, the graphic novel, for something. It's still very much like early in development, so they don't even know if it's going to be like for a streaming network or if it's going to be for cable or whatever. Mm-hmm. All they say is that he's developing it for TV. So it's going to be a series. I am super excited about this. I think actually could translate pretty well to a TV series, and be pretty cool, and they could do some pretty cool things. It does bum me out a little bit that it's with Universal. Mm. Just like content wise, I think it would be better off, obviously, with a service like HBO or something, because they're just not going to tie any hands content wise,
right?
I mean, Happy's gotten really good reviews, and so I don't know. I think they could probably put something pretty cool together.
Yeah. Yeah, I know nothing about this comic book, but you vouched for it. I like Grant Morrison of the stuff I've read by him, and I guess we'll see how it develops. Super excited for Hundreds of Years for that Preacher series, and then when I got it, I became much less excited.
You know, I actually have been revisiting it because I heard that... It's gotten better and better, and I'm about halfway through the first season, and it's not as good as the comic, for sure, but as a series, it's still pretty entertaining. It definitely has a good sense of Garth Ennis's style of humor. I mean, it is a little watered down for TV, but for the most part, it's still pretty... bonkers crazy in all the ways you'd want it to be. So I'm not into it, actually. I think I judged it a little too harshly the first time I watched it, and I actually am excited to catch up with that one.
All right. Okay. First story I have here is director Ben Wheatley is adapting Alfred Hitchcock's gothic classic Rebecca for Netflix. And have you ever seen Rebecca?
No.
If I'm not mistaken, Rebecca is the only Hitchcock movie to win Best Picture.
Oh.
And it's not even like the most Hitchcocky Hitchcock film, if you see it. I mean, it has, you know, his style and, you know. And
no, I kind of know what you mean by that.
Yeah, it's a lot more of a strictly sort of gothic romance kind of film. More so than his, like, later, like, whodunits and, you know, chase films and that kind of stuff that he became really well known for. It has some really weird, psychology to it. In that way, it's very Hitchcockian. It's like, the characters are kind of living all these double lives, and there's, like, all this kind of subtext you can read between the lines about the characters and that kind of stuff. So, it's really interesting on that level. The story itself, I don't know. It's never been my favorite Hitchcock film, but I can see, you know, somebody like Ben Wheatley. We did one of his films for Netflix homework, the movie High Rise. And he's up and coming British genre film director. He's made a lot of movies that have been, you know, critically touted. And I could see him doing something with this. Hopefully he gets a decent enough budget. Yeah, I'd be into seeing an update for Rebecca. I actually don't think, you know, like a lot of his films, like Psycho or whatever, things that did get remade, this isn't as sacrosanct or so tied to Hitchcock's style that I couldn't imagine somebody else doing it. It's based on a novel by the same writer who also wrote the novel that Carol was based on, the movie from a few years ago.
Gotcha. Okay.
So it feels more novelistic than other Hitchcock films, which are maybe more set piece driven.
I really liked the style and sort of the direction of High Rise. It made him one of those directors that I'm like, I'm interested to see what you do in the future, but I think High Rise was by itself a little lacking.
Kind of messy.
Yeah, and so maybe with a more put-together story, his style might work really well with that. So, because a lot of this I don't understand. Like, I've never seen Rebecca. I do really like Hitchcock, but Yeah. Why not? Why not? I mean, if you're going to do remakes, like, at least this is one that, you know, people aren't necessarily as familiar with, and it's not like, like, I heard some fucking thing about how I heard some fucking thing about how maybe some studios, like, pitching a reboot for Back to the Future. You know what I mean? I'm like, yeah, fuck that.
I mean, things like that are always sort of in the air, so I don't know. Yeah. It probably won't happen.
Sure. And if, you know, if there's more of a story to come out of that, we'll definitely bring it up here. But, like, fuck that shit. I'm much more interested in this, where it's like, you know, something that I don't really know and is old enough to where, why not give it a shot?
Yeah.
My only real problem is that it's for Netflix, and
yeah, that's so far, my only, I mean, it's not like a story like Rebecca needs to have lavish, expensive production. It's mostly, you know, about people stuck in a mansion. You know, freaking out about old paintings.
No, so it's just that Netflix as a production studio has been really pissing me off lately, because they're way overproducing. Like,
yeah,
they're just throwing everything at the wall and seeing what sticks. You know, it's even affecting, like, right now there's a fan petition to petition for a third season or a fourth season of Daredevil, because it's sort of up in the air if Netflix is going to cancel it. And it's like, I'm borderline, like, fuck off forever, Netflix. If they cancel Daredevil, I'm like, that's one of the reasons I'm sticking around. Say what you will about the other Marvel Netflix shows, sure, but, you know, I don't know. It really is pissing me off how they're just, like, sort of starting content and then not sort of giving it a chance or following it through.
Right.
And I think their movies have sort of been the worst as far as, let's just produce as much as we can and not give a shit about any of it.
Yeah. Ben Wheatley is a talented enough guy, and it looks like Armie Hammer and Lily James are coming on to play in it. So I feel like they're going to give this one a little bit more treatment than other things.
Yeah. And hopefully, you know, it does seem like the Netflix movies that have a bit more of a pedigree get treated with, a little bit more seriously. So
yeah, and I don't think they would do Hitchcock dirty by, giving it a $20,000 budget and then having Tim Allen star.
We'll see.
Yeah. Okay, final story. Chris Pratt is in talks for a reboot, if you even want to call it that, of The Saint. Do you remember The Saint?
I do, actually.
It's based on a television series starring Roger Moore. He was, like, a spy. I mean, this is, like, before he was in the James Bond films. And then later, it was made as a movie in the 90s, starring Val Kilmer as a sort of master of disguise.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember the movie was kind of boring, actually. Like,
super boring.
I guess. I don't know. It could be good. It's like sort of a spy, like you said, master of disguise thing.
Mm-hmm.
So this could maybe be a cool turn for Chris Pratt to maybe get away from the sort of, younger quippy guy.
Yeah. But the kind of lovable doofus.
Yeah, or maybe not. So we'll see, I guess. You know, The Saint as a property is sort of a weird thing to reboot. Again, I don't care. It's like, fine, give it a shot, whatever.
Right.
I'm more interested in sort of like what Chris Pratt is going to do with his career next, because kind of what we talked about with Jennifer Lawrence a little bit ago. Like, I feel like he's in danger of not doing, like, I think he has to pick his next few projects pretty carefully.
I would agree.
Because he's so the hit, you know, guy that he got so overexposed. I think he could sort of benefit from taking a little bit of time off. And sort of reinventing himself. And maybe this could help him do that. I don't know. And now that I'm saying this, I do think it is kind of funny that he starred with Jennifer Lawrence in a space thriller.
Yeah, that went nowhere. I actually think that was like sort of the straw that broke the camel's back on both of their careers. Now, I don't think that Chris Pratt is in as big of danger as Jennifer Lawrence. I think she's a little bit more in free fall than he is, where he's more just kind of plateaued. But yeah, I think both of them desperately need a career-defining role, which is a really heavy thing to ask for in any time in your career. But at this point, that they need that next level.
Yeah, yeah. Like, he needs something that's very different from his character in Parks and Rec and Guardians of the Galaxy. And I'm not even counting those Jurassic World movies, but... so I guess it all just depends on sort of the tone they're going to go for this. So I can't say if I'm excited or not. I think it's either going to be sort of a fart in the wind that nobody's going to notice, or, you know, if they have a good script and good director, maybe it could be a cool turn.
I don't think this is going to be the thing that does a lot for his career. I strongly doubt it will.
No, but it could maybe sort of turn him in a quieter direction.
Hopefully.
We'll like, see. I don't see this being sort of a big blockbustery thing, and I think that would be good for him.
Yeah, unless they decide to kind of take it more into the Mission Impossible, Fast and the Furious direction.
That's true. Let's be honest, it seems a lot more marketable, so... Yeah, no, we'll see.
All right, that is our movie news. We'll get started here on the reviews, and before we start talking about The Crimes of Grindelwald, I'm going to do a review of this little Netflix movie that I saw called Cam, and I didn't really take this film very seriously when I first saw that it popped up. I thought, oh yeah, it's more Netflix junk, but it actually kind of got like medium to positive reviews. And there was some amount of talk about it online, so I was like, okay, I guess I'll check this out. And I was in a situation where I couldn't, like, run out and see a movie, so it kind of happened that way. But I'll throw my two cents in here. So, this is directed by Daniel Goldhaber, and it's produced by Blumhouse. And it stars Madeline Brewer as a cam girl named Alice on her streaming session. She goes by the name Lola, and she's well known on this particular platform, the site that she does her streaming pornography performances on, as the girl who does the crazy stuff. So other girls, you know, they just like do whatever they do, and she usually ends hers in some sort of ritualistic fake suicide. Because that's what gets her the biggest tips. People who watch these programs tip with tokens. So in order to be able to have her take off her shirt, they got to tip like 50 coins or something like that, and then so on and so forth. And she does this as a career, hasn't told her family, hasn't told anyone that she knows, but she's doing pretty well at this, and she's kind of, her identity is sort of being wrapped into the success of her show on this website. They rank the girls based upon how much they make and how many followers they have. And she really wants to break into the top 50. And so she's kind of going through further and further extremes on her show to be able to reach that level. On the night that she does finally break to the top 50, something weird happens where she wakes up the next day and she has lost all access to her profile on this website. Yet, somebody, some doppelganger, looks and sounds exactly like her, who's sitting in a bedroom that looks exactly like hers, is doing a 24-hour stream in her place. So it becomes sort of this existential, sort of surrealist nightmare mystery where she's trying to figure out how this is happening and find this person and stop them from doing the stream before they ruin her life, because this doppelganger starts to give out more and more personal information about Alice. And there's some other kind of surrounding characters, other girls who work on the site, and these devoted male followers that she sort of runs into and has less unpleasant experiences with. A lot about the premise is actually really interesting, and I think just describing it again, I can see all the potential in that premise, because you're talking about something very topical, kind of ripped from the headlines type of stuff.
I think that's sort of the exact premise of a Twilight Zone episode, actually.
It has that vibe.
Doppelganger.
Right. I mean, we've seen stuff like this before. I was reminded heavily of even the film Videodrome, which deals with a lot of this same kind of stuff, sort of man and technology being an extension of identity. The more and more that we fracture identity into the world of technology, the less and less control we have over identity and what is real and what isn't real, and postmodernist ideas of objectivity sort of being broken down. And so all of that's super interesting. And I think all of that stuff kind of plays out on its own without having to get highfalutin and talk about it. You can still just make it a short thriller and have fun with the premise while being able to explore that stuff implicitly. So most of that works. The acting is a little late night HBO kind of feeling. Okay. And some of that might be intentional and some of it might not. I think there are times when the lead actress feels very confident in the role and very, like she's putting on a persona sort of on purpose, and it feels more satirical. And then there's times where it just feels a little, amateurish. Some of the other actors, even more so, the side characters that we only meet for a scene or two definitely seem a little bit low rent, but maybe not necessarily in a bad way, considering the type of sleazy material we're working with. So it is a bit of a B-movie, and that's fine. I don't have a problem with B-movies. And I think that as long as a B-movie is exploring interesting ideas, that's more than you can ask usually. My biggest complaints with it is that for a movie that's concerning itself with the world of pornography, it doesn't really go for it in a way that I think it needs to. I mean, if you're going to do a film like this, it probably should be NC-17. And you probably should be able to push the boundaries of decency.
And if it's on Netflix, especially, like, if it's, they don't have, cable and FCC and stuff to deal with, they should be able to just...
Right. And like sometimes it does. There are a couple scenes that you can feel they wanted to punctuate to be able to sort of color the rest of what you're saying. But I noticed a lot of you're shooting it in such a way so you don't expose the actress too much and make people uncomfortable or whatever it is. But I feel like that's sort of at odds with the entire premise. And I'm not saying this in like a pervy, like, oh my God, I really want to see, graphic stuff. If it was all about that, I would just log on to other websites, but
for the description, it sounds like it should make you, it should feel a little scandalous and a little,
yeah. If you're dealing in the world of pornography, you should be honest about what that world is. There is a little bit of kind of pulling away and a little bit of whitewashing of what that stuff is. Towards the end, so they, it's sort of a supernatural movie to a certain extent. It's an unexplainable phenomenon. And you can tell that when the person was writing the screenplay, they had all of these kind of grand ideas about identity and about misogyny and about technology and about doxing and our fear of losing privacy in the internet age and all of that kind of stuff. The themes kind of drive the story, which usually I prefer. And in fact, even though this movie does have narrative issues, I like that it prefers to do that. The problem is it writes itself into a corner. At some point, you have to be able to land this airplane. And it kind of just comes to a mediocre conclusion where it's like, okay, well, you know, find this magic spell, turn around three times, and zing. I'm exaggerating, but it is kind of a head scratcher of a conclusion. A little lazy.
Okay. All right.
But I enjoyed it for what it is. Again, it is a B movie, and it's kind of sleazy in sort of a fun way. If people are fans of, you know, something like Brian De Palma thrillers from the 80s or the Italian films that he was inspired by, it has that kind of vibe visually. So there's things to like about it. I don't think it's like a great film, but I get why people are talking about it.
Okay, cool.
Let's go ahead and get into this. Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, and I'll let you describe it.
Okay. What is there to describe? So, this movie opens where where the last Fantastic Beasts franchise movie left off. Grindelwald in full-on Johnny Depp Super Saiyan form escapes from prison and is on the hunt for Ezra Miller's character, I guess, and Newt Scamander is hanging out with his Fantastic Beasts, and when young Dumbledore, played by Jude Law, sort of recruits him to go to Paris to figure out what Grindelwald is up to, and there's wizards, and I don't know, really. I don't know. There was a lot going on.
Sure was.
And to be honest, not a lot of it landed for me. I've been a fan of the Wizarding World stuff so far. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say that J.K. Rowling is full on prequeling like George Lucas. Mm-hmm. But Ashley's worried about it, that's for sure. I mean, here's the thing. It's not like overly dumb like Phantom Menaces or anything like that, but it definitely feels like at this point JK is sort of in her own world and in sort of less concerned with telling a story and more just sort of like living in this fantasy world. I don't know. Like, my problem with the first one was that there weren't enough Fantastic Beasts. There's even less actual Fantastic Beasts in this one. Although the ones that we get are a treat.
Yeah, there's a cool dragon cat creature.
But honestly, my big problem with this movie is that it doesn't have the emotional core that the first movie has. Mm-hmm. There's so much sort of plot setting up, because now it's a franchise.
Right.
That it never even takes a moment to slow down and actually check in with what any of the characters are doing or feeling. So it's just sort of frustrating to me. And even sort of the emotional problem from the first movie, they sort of just wrap up in the first like 15 minutes of this one. It was like, oh, well, we figured that out. Moving on. And that sort of bummed me out. I don't know. I guess I'll just get into more specifics. It really frustrated me that the Muggle character,
mm-hmm. Dan Fogler.
Yeah. So he specifically was sort of what kept me in the first movie.
Yeah.
Because his reaction to the Wizarding World was so fun, and his story was so tragic. And in this one, at the beginning of the first one, he had his memory wiped because he was a Muggle and he'd seen all this magic stuff and it was very Men in Black, you know, like,
yeah,
you can't know about our world. In this movie, he, like, literally they're just like, oh no, we figured it out. And I'm like, really? Like, that's it? Like, I feel like we could have gotten some more dramatic weight out of, like, the Queenie character being in love with him, but, you know, he doesn't remember her. And I feel like all of that could have been sort of her inciting motivation for her to make the choices she does. But instead, it was just like that all felt sort of forced. And there's just so much else going on, but none of it's ever really, like, cleared up or explored. I don't know. I kind of thought this movie was a bit of a mess.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a mess, and it's a slog. It's 2 hours and 14 minutes, and you feel every minute. And it is also pretty dour and boring. This is a boring movie. I was falling asleep through parts of it. Not because I was, like, particularly tired when I went to the movie, but there were times when I started to nod off. And that hasn't happened to me since Rogue One, which this movie kind of reminded me of in some ways. Yeah. Now, it had been a while since I seen the first Fantastic Beasts film, which I remember, like, liking mildly. Not in love with it, but I was okay with it. So I went back and actually listened to our review to kind of be refresh myself. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the stuff that I complained about there, even though I ultimately came, you know, with a thumbs up, is exponentially worse here. One of my complaints of the first film is that it didn't really have a central character. We have Newt that we're following, but there's multiple kind of perspectives and a lot of different kind of story stuff happening in the movie, sort of shifts. And because of that, totally have a set of shoes to sort of ground us into the story. This movie, even more so. Newt reminds me so much, if we're talking about prequelitis, reminds me so much of Bilbo Baggins in those Hobbit prequels, where he is just a prisoner in his own franchise and is not, has zero impact on the story.
Yeah. I think that's what frustrated me the most was, like, but unlike Bilbo, who we at least have the books to sort of have as sort of background information to, I mean, I'm not saying that you should have to rely on that, but we at least culturally, we kind of know Bilbo as a character. He appears in Lord of the Rings. The books exist. So we sort of know what his deal is. Whereas in Fantastic Beasts, this is our first introduction to the character of Newt. So we don't have that. We don't know anything about him. And they try to do this whole love triangle thing. And I actually thought it was more interesting when he was kind of asexual in the first movie and awkward. And I actually thought that was a more interesting choice. Like, so for them to even do that was like, okay, well, now you're also undermining the little we knew about him from the first movie. And it just, it all felt like it was just building to this really unnecessary twist that I just didn't understand or care about. Like, it felt like there wasn't a movie here.
No, really. Yeah.
It felt like it was all just set up for the next movie to come. And that's, I don't know. I was just...
There were a, like, lot of times... There are a lot of times in the film when I'm watching it where I don't know where I am narratively. I'm like, why is this happening? Why are you showing this to me right now? Like, I get that you're being, like mysterious and cagey and you're going to reveal something later, but you just did that 5 scenes in a row, so now I'm just in a place where I'm like, well, if I don't know what any of this means, why do I care?
Yeah, and I think, like, something like where Harry Potter... I think worked a bit better narratively because there was all the mysterious stuff, right? There was all the big story stuff with Voldemort and stuff.
Yeah.
But that wasn't... Then there was also all the school stuff to really ground it in sort of get us through narratively. It wasn't all so focused on this evil wizard. It was like... It felt like these characters living in a more real world than this. So these characters are so obsessed with Grindelwald, and there's all this allegory to war and stuff. And I'm like, I get it, but there's nothing grounding me. There's nothing for me to fall back on, for me to go, like, oh, okay, I understand I understand this world. Where's in?
Well, again, we haven't had six films with these characters prior to this, where we see them books grow with up
even more in-depth backstory.
Right? Yeah, where we see them grow up and see like what their deals. Instead, she's, you know, J.K. Rowling wrote this herself. Instead, she fit the entire franchise, like an entire Harry Potter franchise worth of plot in two movies. And by trying to do it in backstory, you know, there's this character that kind of comes out of nowhere. And she like knew Newt as a child. And then all of a sudden we're like going into flashback of her life. And that all the, and JK like opens up this entire chapter of this character we just met.
Yeah. Are you talking about Zoe Kravitz's character?
Oh, maybe.
Lena Lestrange? Yeah, because that was a whole thing, too, because there's this character whose name is Lena Lestrange, so we know she's related to Bellatrix Lestrange, and even, like, just this sentence is giving me a headache.
Yeah.
And I'm spending more time trying to figure out how this fits into the Harry Potter timeline than I am actually caring about how this all turns out for these characters.
See, I actually didn't do that. I mean, I obvious things like Dumbledore, I can put that together, but
well, yeah,
like,
but I didn't try Dumbledore, to think of like there's Lita Lestrange, there's Nagini as a person and not just a snake now.
Yeah, McGonagall talked about. I don't think we ever meet her in the movie, but. And some of that stuff is like kind of fun, Easter egg-y type stuff, but I'm talking more just about structurally. The way that you meet a character and then all of a sudden the character doesn't just function as a way to keep the plot moving, but instead opens up like an entire room full of new plot. It's like every scene is introducing more plot.
That's what I mean, because it's like, it feels like she's so much more focused on tying this to Harry Potter than just letting it be its own story. Like, it's sort of overwhelmed with Wizarding World stuff but there's no actual story. Like, I don't even know what the plot is, really.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is that it's overwritten. Sure. And there's two emotional, maybe two or three emotional arcs kind of going in this, which is already too many. But there's three things that you're supposed to like ground you. There's this idea of Ezra Miller kind of being seduced to the dark side. I mean, let's call it what it is. And like that's supposed to be sort of emotional because we've saw what happened to him in the previous film. There's the who gives a fuck shit with Newt and Catherine Waterston, which is just like so not happening for me.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And then stop
with that.
Yeah, and then there's the stuff with Dan Fogler and his girlfriend, which actually, of all of those things, I think that pays off the most. Okay. But we get so little of them up to that point.
But also, like, here's what frustrated me is yes, again, the sort of heavy emotional lifting is on Dan Fogler and Queenie. God, what the actress's name I can't think of right now. But I think you could have gotten the same story beats that you needed from those characters and built it off the tension from the first movie instead of completely erasing that. Like, I just didn't feel that those stakes, and I felt like there was an obvious solution there built into the ending of the last fucking movie, but it was just, it's so concerned with sort of moving things along and getting the next wizard thing and getting the next Easter egg, and I don't know. I was pretty frustrated with this. Again, it wasn't a disaster in the way of, like, Attack of the Clones. But I can see it going that way, and that's what's sort of a bummer to me. And I hope they get like a fucking editor for the next one.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't know how many people are really working on these screenplays. It says just J.K. Rowling, based on characters by J.K. Rowling. And she's rich enough that maybe she's cocooned in, you know, her writing room and she just hands these off and they direct it right off the page. I don't know. But they, I don't think she's a good screenplay writer. I think she's probably a good novelist, but she hasn't figured out.
I noticed
this reminds
that a lot.
Me so much of when Cormac McCarthy wrote his own screenplay for that movie. What was that thing that Ridley Scott directed? I forgot what it was called. It had Brad Pitt and people in it, Javier Bardem. But that was a mess. This is similarly a mess. I agree
with that. It's like she doesn't know how to. Like, I think these could probably work as books because she can take the time to sort of flush these characters out and flush
right.
these beats out. But in the, it's not translating to screen the way I think she thinks it might be. But
right.
And even David Yates, who I think did a really good job with the last few Harry Potters, isn't able to sort of bring any kind of humanity to this.
Yeah, it feels just kind of dreary and dour. And there are some, like, cool shots in the movie, and I think that he still can build atmosphere sometimes. And there's some artistry there, but I...
And I think that honestly, let's call these movies what they are. Like, they're trying to set up the Dumbledore character so we can get more with him. And if that's what you're doing, like, let's just make him the fucking main character at a certain point.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what we're gearing up to.
And I think that's what worked in this movie is, you know, Jude Law is he's a great actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he for the few scenes that he has as Dumbledore, he's certainly compelling, and I think he captures the character. Like, you can't really tell if he's using Newt or there's good seeds being planted. I just don't want to have to wait four fucking movies to get there. Like, you know, I just want to shake the people involved and saying, do what you're trying to do in four movies, but take out all the bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah. This is like a C minus for me. I just, yeah, and I only really give it that high of a grade because there's some good performances in here. Actually, I think Johnny Depp was decent. I at least know what he's doing in this movie.
He didn't break the movie the way I was afraid he was going to. I still preferred Colin Farrell's portrayal because it seemed a little more tortured. I know we didn't know he was Grindelwald at the time, but
right.
He just seemed like he had a little bit more going on, whereas, you know, Johnny Depp is playing it pretty broadly villainous.
Yeah.
But you know, he has a pretty fun sort of action scene in the beginning, and the magical beasts we do get are pretty fun. Like you said, the giant cat monster.
Yeah, actually at this point I think like that's
just
so
get away
not
from
even
that.
I actually think like let's write Newt out at this point. Because
I agree,
he's not really doing much for the story, and whatever is going on with him is generally sort of a distraction from the actual narrative.
I would be fine with him sort of becoming a secondary character or whatever, but if the movie's just shifted to being about Dumbledore,
I think it would probably be stronger. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, but I'm afraid that two movies in. It's probably a little too late for that. So we'll see where it goes. But yeah, I actually gave it the same grade, a C minus.
Yep.
There's some visually interesting stuff going on, but story wise, it's all over the place.
For sure. All right. Well, let's get into the Netflix homework then. This is the film that I had us watch. Touch of Evil, 1958. This is written and directed by Orson Welles.
And also starring Orson Welles.
Yes, which is often the case in an Orson Welles joint. And it is a border town thriller starring Charlton Heston as a police officer. Okay, so one of the things this movie's really well known for is like the kind of unforgivable brown face.
Yeah,
that's going on.
I was gonna talk about that because it's distracting as fuck.
So Charlton Heston is playing a Mexican in this movie. So
he's playing like the Mexican. He's playing like the he's playing the only good Mexican in the movie. It's problematic at best.
At best, yes. He plays a sort of prosecutor or a police officer or something named Mike Vargas, who's trying to take down a crime syndicate that's sort of hovering on either side of the Mexican-American border. Orson Welles is playing a police officer on the American side named Hank Quinlan, who's sort of a drunk and a dirty cop. And Janet Leigh and Mike Vargas, Janet Leigh is playing his newlywed wife. They're on a honeymoon. And just as they're kind of settling down, a crime happens in the city where a man is killed in his vehicle. But because the bomb might have been planted on the car in Mexico before it traveled to the American border, we have these kind of two different police factions sort of trying to get down to the bottom of this or trying to cover it up.
And sort of fighting over jurisdiction a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
a lot of interested parties.
Yeah, and it seems like Charlton Heston's character is, you know, a good noble cop, mm-hmm. and Orson Welles just wants to sort of close the case.
Yeah, he's beyond world weary. At this point, he kind of sees his job as more of a matter of just making things go away,
which isn't something that doesn't happen in real life.
Yes, yes, there's some strange similarities to things that are happening around the borders nowadays.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is one of Orson Welles' bigger movies. He did a lot of movies, but this is one that people sort of reference often, especially if it was a highlight of the film noir era. And I think for good reason. This is stylish as fuck. There's a lot of really cool single takes in this movie. The movie begins with this like long single take fluid camera thing.
Opening shot is fucking insane.
Yeah, especially for that time, because they didn't have like the small little lightweight cameras that we have nowadays. It was like a huge, you know, rig on a crane that they had to make all of this happen on.
Yeah, and it's like a 10-minute single take tracking shot.
And I'm sure there's some like hidden cuts or whatever, but it still flows really well.
And it's I'm gonna get this out right out of the way, right out of the butt. I don't think I've ever seen an Orson Welles movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You've never seen Citizen Kane?
Well, okay, are we counting the 1985 Transformers film, which he didn't direct, but he did provide the voice of Unicron as his final performance?
No. No, nor do we count Muppets Take Manhattan.
Okay. In that case, I've never seen an Orson Welles movie.
Okay.
Citizen Kane is definitely on my list of shame. But I watched this, and from a directorial perspective, brown face aside, I was like, holy fuck, like the shots are so modern for this time.
1958. Like, there is a lot of like, first of all, there's a lot of like use of outdoor. Like, this isn't, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of, like, stuff in a soundstage, but it doesn't feel like a movie that's constricted to a soundstage. There's a lot of open door shots and a lot of, you know, moving from one building, then crossing the street into the next building where the camera follows all the way. The movie is constantly moving. The camera is either pushing forward or following a character.
The pacing of this movie's awesome too, because it all sort of takes, it feels like it takes place within about 24 hours. Like, it almost feels like it's taking place in real time.
Yeah.
Because it's just like this one incident happens and it just sort of keeps going. Like, it feels like the characters don't ever really get a break.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sort of helps you see Orson Welles' character, Quinlan. I think it helps you see sort of why he's weary. Mm-hmm. And I have a question. This is a bit of a non sequitur.
Okay.
Do you think Harvey Bullock, the Batman character, is based off of this character?
Possibly. I mean, he's been written different ways and different things. I think probably most people are familiar with Harvey Bullock in the Batman animated series, which isn't a dirty cop per se, but sort of a schlub.
They kind of get that here as well, because like, so there's this thing where he sort of keeps talking about how he trusts his gut and mm-hmm. and how I think they allude to the fact that like his gut was right, even though he went about it in sort of the worst possible way.
Yeah.
Like he doesn't need proof, but he still is. Up until a certain point in the film, he definitely crosses that line into full-on villain, into full-on dirty cop.
Yeah.
But up until that point, they play with the idea that even though he's not doing it properly, he's still doing the right thing, which, again, it, for the time period, is raising some complex moral questions. And also, I didn't know, I always sort of heard of Orson Welles as a director more than an actor. Like, I knew he was in stuff, but I thought it was more like sort of cameos and stuff. Like, he's fucking good.
No, yeah, this is a incredible performance, powerhouse performance, I'd say. And he stars in Citizen Kane as Charles Foster Kane.
And he
made Citizen Kane. Like, this movie came out in 1958. Citizen came out in 1940. So this is 18 years later. I think he was like 25 when he made Citizen Kane, and he plays the character from a young age to old age very convincingly. That's one of the reasons why people call it such a good movie and why it's such a, you know, staple of classic cinema.
Gotcha. Yeah,
as well as all of the bravura filmmaking that we see here, you know, we saw it as early as his first film then.
Well, this Orson Welles guy is going places.
He sure is. He comes from the world of theater. He directed plays. Even during the time that he was making movies, he did a lot of Shakespeare. And he made, you know, I think he's most well known for, in the movie world, either doing thrillers like this, or doing Shakespeare adaptations like Othello. And you could say that there is aspects of Citizen Kane and Touch of Evil that's Shakespearean.
Yeah, yeah, I can see that for sure. They don't really take the time to sort of separate his acting from his directing, and I was just really impressed with his performance.
And
I mean, most of the performances in general, aside from Charlton Heston, who, even besides his brown face, is, you know, he's Charlton Heston. He's a big actor. I think he always has been a bit of a ham.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think that he's the problem with this movie, per se. I mean, I'm not crazy about, like, casting him as a Mexican. And that definitely doesn't age well.
Yeah.
But I think that if we're just looking at him as sort of a square-jawed, sort of, you know, hero type, he fills that role just fine. He's not meant to be the most interesting character here.
No, that's true.
But yeah, I would agree. So sort of the more morally complicated characters are the more interesting characters and seem to be more in line with the tone of the movie.
Yeah, I just, I almost think it would, yeah. I'm not going to rant about the brown face too much, but it is, like I said, just it's distracting because also Charlton Heston's such a big movie star,
right?
You know, he's so well known that to see him all done up like that, you just kind of can't help but see his makeup that the whole performance, and I just could never sort of really believe him,
right?
But
I think it helps that this is a black and white film, though. I mean, yes, I know that that's a true. Minor like detail in terms of what they're doing with the whitewashing. I don't think it
breaks the movie, to be clear. Like, I think there's enough going on that if you're able to look past that as sort of a, well, it was a different time, because it was, and you know, I am glad they're getting away from that now, but if you're able to sort of look past that, then I think, you know, the movie is still complex and interesting enough and that it's worth watching despite that.
Yeah, it's also really dark. Like, there's some, like, pretty, I mean, it's, you know, it's all done, you know, either off camera.
Oh, I mean, there's like some Breaking Bad type stuff going on here.
Yeah.
Like, it goes places I was not expecting it to go.
Yeah, for sure. And this, you know, 58, we're edging right on 1960. So the studio code is starting to dissipate and starting to crumble at this time. This is when we start seeing edgier stuff from the studio system, even before they do away with the code. And this definitely has that feeling of, like, that kind of right almost there. Like, this is the type of movie where people are like, okay, are we still really paying attention to this anymore? Like,
gotcha.
Like this and like movies like Night of the Hunter and stuff like that were starting kind of come out around this time. And then Janet Leigh would be in Psycho only a couple years later.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, overall, I think this, if you're into noir, if you're into crime thrillers, like, this doesn't really feel that dated, to be honest. There's a couple moments, there's a couple moments near the end where, like, some of the plots get a little convoluted, and I think the climax could have been a little, you know, might have been a little punchier in a modern movie, but overall, I felt like this movie held up pretty well.
Yeah, me too. I was really taken with the visual direction specifically, and the cinematography.
Yes. Yeah.
And the fluid camera work and the way that the transitions from scene to scene and how the movie is just constantly kinetic and moving and doing every, like Citizen Kane, it's almost like every shot is an effect shot of some sort, but not in a way that makes you exhausted.
No, it just feels a lot more modern than movies that, you know, were shot in this era. Like, you know, even like Night of the Hunter, which you mentioned.
Yeah.
Does that very 50s thing where it'll sit on a really long shot for a lot longer than it probably should have because it's focusing on performances and stuff, whereas this one is really using like camera shots and angles and editing in ways that feel like it feels like he's experimenting with, okay, well, what can we tell with the fact that this is a movie, besides just the acting?
Yeah. How can the camera tell the story?
Yeah. How can the lighting and the angle and the quickness of the editing? And I think it's also funny because at the beginning of the movie, it has sort of a... it has a bit of a thing like explaining how this isn't exactly what the finished product that Orson Welles wanted.
Oh, yeah. It has a disclaimer.
Disclaimer. Yeah, that's the word.
At the beginning of the film.
And saying that they sort of re-edit it to try and get it as close to Orson Welles' vision as possible. But I was like, I don't know. I didn't feel...
No, like, it does. Like, the restoration, whatever they did, is seamless. I know. I see here, if you look it up on IMDb, it says an hour and 35 minutes. But if you watch,
yeah,
if you watch it on Netflix, it's about an hour 50. So that's a lot of footage that made its way back into the Orson Welles cut. And it, I can't imagine where those cuts would have been or what they decided to get rid of. Maybe it was stuff for the content. Maybe it was some of the darker stuff they had to cut around at the time, and it made its way back in after. That would take some,
yeah,
some research.
Yeah. And I, you know, if you're bored and really interested in it, it's certainly interesting. So yeah, I think that is, that could be cool. So I don't know if any of our listeners, you know, happen to know any of that, that'd be stuff we'd be interested in knowing. But
yeah, totally.
Yeah, so if you're into film history and you're into, you know, specifically noir, and you're into to Dirty Cops, and I even, like I said, I even got little shades of like without this movie, I feel like a show like Breaking Bad could have never existed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's great. You know, when people talk about this movie for a reason. Yeah. And I was glad to finally have seen it.
Yeah. I might have to check out this little Citizen Kane that everybody's been talking about now.
Yeah.
So it definitely made me sort of a lot more interested in going back and looking at his other work than I'm probably ever would have been before.
All right. What did you have for me next week?
So I'm going to go in the exact opposite direction of a movie from 1958. We're going to watch the Coen Brothers Netflix original, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which just came out like last week.
That snuck up on me. I knew they had something coming out. I didn't know it was that soon, and I didn't know it was on Netflix. So that's cool.
Yeah.
And I'll be excited to talk about that. Well, if anybody has anything to say about any of the things we talked about in this episode, you can get in contact with us on email at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at JabberPodcast. You can stream the show and listen to it on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, and Google Play. And you can check me out on my personal Twitter at VC Cassidy, VCCASSIDY. And you can also read my stuff at the Idaho State Journal. .com. I'm not really updating my blog anymore because Idaho State Journal is doing a decent enough job at that I can just link from there. So go there, and they should have a movie section somewhere on there. You can click on that and read my stuff. Yeah, what do you have?
Yeah, so Book Club, which is the improvised show I do every month. We do improvise a different genre story. We're doing a show Saturday, December 8th, which is a holiday special. So we're doing, it's not really a book genre so much as we're improvising a shitty Christmas movie, like a Christmas Prince or the holiday Hallmark Christmas specials.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really over the top and really fun. So come check that out at Old Town Improv Company Saturday, December 8th at 9 p.m. Please come check out the show. It's a really cool show, and we need audience there. Also, I am going to be doing another alt comedy show at Old Town Improv Company on Friday, December 21st. I don't have the full lineup announced yet, but I'll have that up on my website at www.keithfosterkid.com. Also, most of the shows I've been doing lately have been at Old Town Improv Company. You can always check out their website at oldtownimprov.com for show tickets. You can also follow me on Instagram and Twitter at keithfosterkid. And that's about all I have for the rest of the year. So,
cool. Be sure to check out our other friends out there who are doing podcasts of their own, including Patrick and Dennis over at Almost Educational. Two episodes up now, or two more episodes, I should say, after their hiatus. So it looks like they're back into the swing of it. Less so, Rod and Moksha over at the Listening Party, but we'll see what happens there. And check out Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums podcast. And check out Mike Valick over at Hack Thought. And check out Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places.
Cool. Also check out my friends Marilyn Bowe at Campfire Shit Show and Adam Connie with the Adamant podcast.
Yes. And that is the show.
You're a wizard, Newt. I didn't really have anything.
Did you see that meme I posted of Samuel L. Jackson in some movie where he dressed as Hagrid for some
You're
reason?
A wizard, motherfucker! Yeah, that was a good one. Okay, that can be it.